Hello, everybody, and welcome to Lost Explorers. My name is J. David Osborne, and that is Chris Sagnissim. Chris, how are you doing this evening?
David, I'm well, thank you. I had an
You're
interesting.
chomping at the bit. You're chomping at the bit to get it rocking and rolling. Before we started recording, you were ready to rock and roll.
Okay, I'll tell you why. I didn't mention this actually to you. I had a really weird teaching day today, really difficult class. I got actually a little bit angry, which is not usual for me. And it's not usually needed. And then a really great, my other class is just humming. But in the middle, I did a solo piano recital at the music school. And
Cool.
it's really, yeah, it was cool. I was nervous about it, but I was pleased about it. And it's kind of an Erik Satie sort of related theme. Very, Parisian Spring was what I was going for. So, but
Very cool.
yeah. And
I
you've
have
had
something.
flooding.
So our apartment flooded a few days ago because the neighbors upstairs accidentally lit their kitchen on fire, and the runoff went down through the vent out into the kitchen. Just made a mess. Everything still kind of smells. It's one of those, water is just, you need it. You got to have it to live, but man, you don't want it in your house at all. It's a
No,
problem. It's a problem.
no.
So,
On every level, electrical, mold, ev so many levels, so many levels. Yeah.
But I wanted to share something with you that I saw. My friend Jay Springett sent this to me. It's an article from Slate. Don't worry, it's a good one. You have to qualify that now when you share something from Slate. Do you remember when Slate used to be really good?
I
Because I
do.
do.
I do. I do. And I think you could actually not single them out, but include several other, similar types of outlets that, yeah, went the same way. No, I hear you.
This is called The Parents in My Classroom. It's written by Liz Shulman. The subtitle of it is How My Students Stay Tethered Via FaceTime and email to their homes. This article points out something that I have noticed in my year of teaching. As you know, and listeners by this point know, my major bone of contention with teaching is the problem of the cell phone. And whenever I've brought it up with other teachers or administrators, they've told me the same thing, which is that the reason why they haven't banned cell phones is because the parents have been vehemently against it. The parents. This is a parent thing. Now, I think that's a little bit wishy-washy. I feel like you should be able to put your foot down and say, I don't really care. Security experts have gone on record saying that kids having cell phones during an active shooter situation would be detrimental to their safety, not a help. And that's usually the big bad reason trotted out for why they need to. But really, what you find, especially through the examples that articles like this put forth, is that we have reached a new stage of the helicopter parent. I'll read you a few excerpts here. Recently, one of my ninth grade English students told me her parents rewarded her for making the honor roll by allowing her to text them during class. They like to know what I'm doing in the classroom as it's happening live, she said. We have a cell phone policy, I reminded her. I know, she said, but you can always break it to message your parents. My student was partly right. Emergencies happen. Parents want access to their kids, but this wasn't an emergency. When my dad texts and asks me how I am, another ninth grader said, he gets worried if I don't message back immediately. Her friend said, my mom expects a text each class period so she knows what I'm doing. Now, I just want you to hear a few things. So,
Wow.
number one, the parents can monitor their Chromebook activity, which is a little big brother-ish. Actually, it's a lot Big Brother-ish. Let's see. There were some really good examples. Oh, okay. Here we go. I have two from this article. A few months ago, one of my students sneakily took a picture of a spelling quiz and sent it to his mother. 10 minutes later, students were still taking the quiz. I received an email from her asking why I had given it and if he could instead take it the next day so he can review more. The student hadn't prepared for the quiz and was understandably anxious. He'd also been trained that his mom would take care of it for him. But as soon as she took over, the opportunity for him to work through his frustration was gone. If he had experienced the natural consequence of being unprepared, chances are that he would have studied for the next time. The lesson available to him could have been greater than studying for one quiz, but he didn't learn it. One more. I'll paraphrase this next one. There's an example of a mother during COVID monitoring a class discussion that the children were finally getting into about Romeo and Juliet. And they were talking about romantic love and love at first sight and whether or not love lasts forever. And she emailed the teacher during the discussion that said the subject line read, all caps, "I can hear everything and I don't like it." One more. This past semester, another student violated the cell phone policy by FaceTiming with her mother in our classroom minutes after receiving a grade she didn't like on a paper. I was about to conference with each student. Since the mother had already talked with her daughter, this student, like the one who had taken the photo of the spelling quiz, refused to talk with me about it. The mother told her daughter to tell me to call her immediately, even though she knew we were in the middle of class. I made no headway with this mother. I told her we have a cell phone policy and explained that phones take away from our classroom community. Community, she asked. Then, before I could answer, told me it was perfectly fine for her to be in contact with her daughter throughout the day because she needs me. Okay, so I've been a little bit hard on these kids, I think, this year. It might actually be my generation that has taken helicopter parenting to the next level. I've experienced similar things in my classroom. There are a few students who are athletes who have battle axe moms who, as soon as something goes wrong, like they're on your phone. Why is this happening? How do we fix this? And the kids whose mothers act that way, they do have a kind of smug, like they don't do very much. They're like, meh, mom will take care of it type thing. But man. At the end of the day, this is just, it's bad parenting, first of all, but also it's weak administration. When did they become such pussies that they can't just say, sorry, no, no phones at all in class, deal with it?
Well, look, I think you're raising some really important issues that we should then, I think, really kick into the main segment because I think we're talking about education. We were talking about the relationship between travel to tourism and
Yeah.
how metaphorically might shed some light on education. But I think you've raised some really, really interesting points. I would mention just while we're just immediately on the topic that Jonathan Haidt, Haidt, I think many of our listeners will be familiar with him. I know that you think highly of him. He has a new book coming out right now called The Anxious Generation that deals with all of these issues. And I just read a great review and then interview with him. And I think it's a must read. I think it's really. I think it's coming out on the 23rd, so he's doing the publicity for it. But The Anxious Generation. But
Yeah.
I want to carry on this conversation, David, because I think you've raised some really interesting points. And I think it's very difficult to, even contemplate the fact, as you said very honestly, that it might be your generation, slightly older people, who are creating a lot of the issues when we're pointing fingers at social media and the phones themselves, and of course, the young people. that maybe, yeah, there's some weird stuff going. I want to hear more about that. And I have some thoughts because I'm also dealing with it with older students. So parents are out of the equation. You know, I'm on the other side of the law that way, that I can't talk to parents if they have inquiries. So it's a very different sort of situation. But we'll come
Totally.
back around to that.
Yep.
You have your five words. Okay, so it's aphorism time. I've got two because the first one isn't really mine, but it is something I think that we need to think about. Every once in a while, I revisit some of the really great basic mathematical principles. This is a key axiom of geometry. If two different lines intersect, they intersect in exactly one point. I just love the language of that. I love the structure. I think Euclidean geometry and his expressions really underpin so much of the best of what we call reason in Western culture. And not to over-celebrate reason, because it has a lot of problems, and David and I often take issue with it and adopt a more Mysterian, magical point of view. But nonetheless, there are moments where it really is magical and it really has something kind of cool to say. And I think it just, if two different lines intersect, they intersect in exactly one point. I just love the assurance of that. It makes me feel good. But I wanted to complement that with my own contribution. And I thought, well, given that sort of axiom of geometry, I'll respond with a short poem. So here we go. Morning dove, wind pine tree, what more music need there ever be? Just a little rhyme there. And the band, are we ready?
Ready.
This is, they're called the Angst Big Thing. If you make a mistake with next, that's what you get. Okay. And their album is called Dark O'Clock. And here's the description. A gritty mongrel version of my morning jacket with sort of a Kelby and Brian Allen Carr aura of car metal, meth, and monster drinks. They're a pretty straightforward bar band, really, but they do strategically and confrontationally introduce traditional instruments like the fiddle, the musical saw, and hammer dulcimer. And here are a couple of tracks from their album, Dark O'Clock. Don't Drink Chicken Water, Third Husbands, Spotted Dog on a Spotted Couch, For Those Who Get Murdered in a West Virginia Cave, and Chaser Round the Room.
See, it's so interesting too because I wonder where song titles and album titles like that have gone. You know, we have Shake It Off and Texas Hold'em. Why not have fun with it? Why not make them puns? I mean, I don't know. I think that would be a much more fun environment to be in. But what do I know? That band sounds like it rules, and it actually sounds like something that I'd probably listen to. Good work. Nicely done. Do you
Thank
have
you.
my imaginative challenge for today?
I do. I do. You know, at this moment in history, it is very, very difficult for us to grasp how insanely popular taxidermy was in the 19th century. It was everywhere. On every level, from the humblest homes to grand mansions and lodges and specialty clubs, taxidermy was a huge, huge thing. And the psychological, cultural psychological explanation is that there was suddenly a sense of lost wilderness, that the buffalo carcasses piled beside the railroad, the pillaging of nature, the onslaught against the animal kingdom in America made taxidermy an elegiac necessity in terms of a hobby and home decoration. So, your imaginative challenge, and we need a scenario in which to discover this. You're faced with the taxidermy of tomorrow. Okay, so not even the taxidermy equivalent of today. We're going to be very interested in what your take on that is, because you're going to have to build from that to what might be the next big thing, so to speak, to keep up with our theme of the band name. In 25 years' time, what would, say, Gus, when he's your age, so maybe, yeah, a little bit older even, what will be the taxidermy equivalent of that day? And again, we're interested in what your thoughts on are, what the taxidermy equivalent of today is. But you've got sort of some scenario building there.
Yeah, I'm getting better at seeing where you're going with these because as I was writing notes about what you were saying, I actually was able to do my notes at the same time. I had a feeling of where it was going.
Good. Well, see, this is what we're, for listeners, this is what we're talking about. It is a kind of telepathic possibility, and following associative rhythms that then kind of start building. And this is when we're really having good conversations. We feel that energy. It's the old William Burroughs thing of, where two minds come together, there's the presence of a third mind. And that comes back into our third man in the woods theme, which we've often put forward, that triadic energy is so rewarding.
I agree. The third man is present this evening. All right. We pull up some notes here. Do.
And I
Have you?
certainly do want to get back to some of the issues you raised at the start.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we absolutely will. Oh, you sent me a text. That's what it was. All right, here we go. Rock and roll. We said last time that we were going to investigate further how the distinction between travel and tourism might help us understand what's happened to the project of national public education in America. An odd proposition to some, perhaps. But I think this is easily done. Although it's also easy to be very hard on tourism. Travel can take many forms, but it's never crass. Tourism can't escape that tinge, that odor. Looking deeper, travel suggests an openness to experience, a willingness to take risks, and to confront unexpected situations, even illness, violence, natural calamity, or falling in love. Tourism is precisely focused on at least managing risk, streamlining possibilities, reducing the unexpected, and delivering a consistent experience. Experience as product, right off the conveyor belt. I want to stop right there because when you are a tourist in a different country, a different state, even, and you are going on these tours, I've always found those to be incredibly erotic in their own way. And I think maybe that's like a little bit of that travel adventure, falling in love thing, trying to break free. Of course, nothing ever happens because everybody's very much on their own track. You're going this way, I'm going this way, and we're passing. But I don't know if you've ever felt that just on a tour of Gettysburg or something like that. You'll see somebody there and you'll think to yourself, oh, I wonder what that's like. I wonder if that's a soulmate, you know? And then you just go your own way. Because if you were traveling and you had just met there in the woods, maybe you could have. But that has been sort of washed out in terms of modern tourism.
I like that that notion of the erotic element and implicitly kind of almost a heightened erotic element because it's inherently frustrated,
Yeah.
from the
Yeah.
very beginning. I think there's
Yeah.
something very interesting in
And
that.
before phones, right? Especially before phones, when I was, a teenager, maybe 12, I would often go to visit my grandmother who lived in Northern Virginia. And she'd plop me down in DC and just say, go have fun, whatever. But man, it brings me back to be 12 and looking at girls and,
Yeah.
girls who are on, tours from local schools, maybe not even local schools, and just like, oh, but that's, I guess, actually, in my case, then that was travel in a sense, because I didn't have any money. I was wandering around, I was more of a traveler. But even now at 37, when Rios and I will go to, different places in like a tourist capacity, that sexual energy is still kind of there. And you're kind of like, well, I'm in that zone. Got to be good, of course, but if I'm being honest, that feeling is still there.
Yeah. That really resonates with me. I think that, that preteen year, I think 12 is really a crucial time, that there's so much more ambient energy in
Oh,
terms
yeah.
of girls. And I remember that really much, really more so than like at 16. I think that,
Yep, I
and
agree.
not to say that the luster had worn off, but it just wasn't, it just wasn't the same, It's a lot clear. I think the agendas were a lot clearer, whereas there was just this vibe, I think of, yeah, a lot of really, I think of summer carnivals, checking girls out there, and just that, you hear the sound
Oh
of
man,
flies
yeah.
and stuff,
Yeah,
and
yeah. And
it.
you're always like, I mean, I have a few really good memories of carnival atmospheres and just, you're both, you're in that age range and you're looking for the spot behind the porta potties. Because
Yeah.
it doesn't have to be perfect. It's just got to be a spot,
Yes,
And
yes.
then
Under
kind
the
of by
bleachers,
Yeah, by the time you're 16 or whatever, I mean, you're still doing that, obviously. But yeah, that excitement of just like, there's a carnival up in the city. People from all over Oklahoma are going to go there. Again, no phones. You don't know this person's name and you're never going to see him again. Oh, gets me. Gets me.
Well, that suggests that there, see, I think this is what we're getting to with the travel tourism dichotomy or opposition, is that there really is a crossover element where people who are on tours can have the fantasy of travel. And in a more open-ended situation, and yet they have, at significant guardrails, significant guardrails. And I think you've done a good job of saying how those guardrails can actually, although they frustrate things like erotic desire and connection, they heighten the buzz of it in a weird, weird way, the craving for it, perhaps. And that's an interesting element of tourism that I hadn't thought of. I think that that's, and I think that applies, if I understand really the larger thing of you mean, what you mean, that yes, it's erotic in its literal sense, but perhaps more metaphorically, all embracing, more on the line of sensuality and just general engagement. Yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think that when you are Traveling and touring too. Touring has a kind of domesticated facsimile of this, but human beings start to appear as nodes of potentiality, right? And places start to seem that way too. Alleyways, different restaurants, all these different opportunities open up, specifically when you don't have an itinerary. So Rios and I, when we do travel, it's very touristy. We definitely have places that we want to go visit and see, but we always leave a couple of days open for wandering. We pick a spot and we go and we wander, and that's kind of about as close to that as we get. But man, it's cool, because even though it's a small chance, right, you're not going to get mugged in Seoul. You might get mugged in London, but probably not. You're still kind of off the beaten path just a little bit. What's around here? Well, whatever we can find, I guess.
Well, it's interesting that off the beaten path, because you're talking in spatial terms, like where you wander, what neighbors, that kind of thing. But really, you started off talking more about wandering in time, of having some open time. There's a wonderful Indonesian Malaysian term for it, jalan-jalan.
Jalan-jalan. Yep.
You know,
Absolutely.
and it
Yep.
really is that kind of being off the leash, not having a program. Really just being, I mean, I think that state of being is perhaps the ideal educational, inspired state of curiosity, just relaxed but inspired curiosity, and just feeling like you can just kind of, free form, freestyle it a bit. What a wonderful, wonderful, feeling that is.
It
And
is, yeah.
But, here's the thing, and I think this is the bridge between travel and tourism, and we'll get around to how this all connects with education at some point. But I think that there are people, and I happen to be related to some, who they might say that they support Jalan-Jalan, but they do not. They do not. They want everything as tightly scheduled as possible, which inherently means overscheduled, overbooked. And the result is that, vacation travel becomes vacation stress, becomes really like a kind of job. And it ties way back into one of my early aphorisms, which I find myself coming back to all the time. I live it. And it was a really simple kitchen level one of, don't cook for the stove. And I come back to that a lot.
I like
I think to
that.
myself,
I
wait a
like
minute, I could
that.
just turn down the heat and take a little bit of agency and control, But I think that this idea of how people could travel and yet not have the open-endedness of Jalan-Jalan, because that's kind of scary, or they might fear that they're going to be wasting their time. They need to be doing everything, and they certainly need to be taking photographs,
Yeah,
and documenting it. So I wonder if it, it kind of ties back into this is really cool. And obviously I didn't plan this because I hadn't heard what you were talking about before. But when you were saying that your generation is parents, super helicopter parents, are behind some of these unfortunate mutations with phone behavior and their consequences, I think that in a weird, that's kind of putting, reversing, it's an inversion. We talk about our technique of inverting things. That's a beautiful example of that. I think the same applies on the travel tourism front, where tourists didn't get created as consumers. They may have to take a lot more responsibility for it, because the people who were, originally bought into that program and are still committed to it, 50, 75 years into the development of the industry, they might have done that because they're the kind of tick the box people.
Yeah.
They needed the conveyor belt, so the
Right.
conveyor belt showed up. I like that. I hadn't really. That makes perfect sense. It consumers create demand, not the other way
Right.
around. But I like that thinking.
Yeah, I like that too. I think that most people also, by the way, are probably more like that. They need that kind of structure, and they need to be able to have an itinerary that they follow. When they go on these trips, the consumer creating the demand is really interesting, because so often now with the phones and the internet, we think about these tech companies as sort of forcing things on us,
Exactly.
which is true. I mean, it is
Yes,
true. It
but
is
not the
true,
whole truth.
but not the whole truth, right? Because they have to figure out what our lizard or monkey brain is looking for first, and then satisfy that need. So if we didn't need it in the first, this freaking thing wouldn't exist if nobody wanted it. People would try it
Exactly.
out and say, "What is this? I don't want this." But no, we think this thing is awesome. That's the real problem.
I think this, it's just, this seems like a very simple point on one level, but I think it's something we all need to remind ourselves about. And I didn't think the conversation was going to go this way. I think this is very interesting that it just organically emerges. But we have all got to take more responsibility for what's going on today. At least, certainly on this whole tech front. And this ties in with the Jonathan Haidt book. I mean, he's targeting, Gen Z and the alpha people, but it really speaks to us all that we do
It
have
does, yeah.
choices about this. We
Yes.
can't go around claiming agency and identity on one level and then just go completely sheep victim on the tech front. I mean, yes,
Yep.
the tech companies are, of course, they're trying to exploit us. Absolutely. They're big corporate machines. But nonetheless, we empower the machine,
Absolutely. I mean, we have to judiciously decide how we use our technology. That's what people like Byung-Chul Han have said, proponents of slow living, dumb phones. Nobody is suggesting to anybody that we become Amish, and nobody's being a Luddite about any of this. I reject all of those concerns out of hand,
Me too.
because the pendulum has swung so far
Yes,
to the
yes.
other side that it's not ludism to just exercise a little bit of self-restraint when it comes to these things. And I'm talking about me, you, the people directly around me. Just I think about this in terms of my eating habits as well. My brother is a full-on vegan, and that's totally like he can do that if he wants to. It's not for me. The way that I address in my own small way the problem of factory farming is by simply not buying Tyson chicken nuggets. Now, it's a little thing. I'm not a freedom fighter by doing that, but I'm exercising a little bit of agency in what kind of chicken I decide to buy. And people can scoff at that all they want, the hardcore people can, but that is analogous to what I'm suggesting when it comes to phones, right? Maybe just don't spend 3 hours a day on Candy Crush, TikTok, and Facebook. I don't feel like that's a huge, maybe just check it like it's a tool to see if you've got any updates, which is what I do with Facebook. I go on there, I'm on Facebook. I can pull up my screen time, but I'd reckon about 15 minutes a day just to see what's up. And then I
Yeah.
leave, you know.
Yeah.
I think that But it's a bit depressing, right? Because we're talking about people here. But I do think that if people in general got that memo of like, hey, nobody's telling you to throw your phone in a lake. We're just saying pull back a bit, just a bit. We were driving back from Dallas today because we took a detour to Dallas for a few days while they supposedly cleaned my apartment. I don't know. Still smells like a dirty towel to me, but whatever. We were driving back 3 hours and Gus was bored and he was just babbling, talking, talk, 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 talk. And for 3 hours, I just listened to him babble and talked back to him. My point is that how many parents handed that kid a tablet at 3 years old and showed them it's not okay to be bored. Like he was making up things in his head about Spider-Man and Superman, and he was talking about how they were fighting and he was using his imagination. And I
Right.
didn't want to break that spell by, you know, telling his mom like, oh, show him a Bluey YouTube video or whatever, right? We start doing this to people from a very young age. And the suggestion is to just kind of do what I did, which is like spend 3 hours of just being bored and listening to a toddler talk. That's not being a Luddite, it's just being a human being.
Well, boredom is such an important experience. You know, it really is I think boredom is the mother of all invention. You know, it really is.
Many very, 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 very intelligent people agree with you.
It's really an essential human experience and one to be really kind of treasured and savored, I think. And to some extent, you could really, I think, identify intelligence as how one deals with boredom, you know. Response to that, it says a lot about creativity, inventiveness, innovation, all those things. But you know, I wonder, we're kind of there's an interesting sort of framework forming, because I think that when we're talking about accepting more responsibility and therefore asserting with some confidence some true agency about these forces in our lives, which is something, you know, it's not just phones, it's everything. You know, we need to have a kind of balanced approach, just as you were saying, to food. You know, I think it's these people who need to have these either-or things that it's very rigid and they have an orthodox mindset. I don't know how they function. But I wonder, you know, we talk today in society at large, but certainly anyone in teaching wonders about the rise of ADHD and things like that. And I wonder, you know, what if we say, okay, the consumer creates the demand, not the other way around? What if we say, actually, how boredom gets handled then becomes a self-reinforcing thing? Oh, you're bored. My God, we've got to stimulate you. So then we up the stimulus need, and pretty soon we've got a feedback loop, and we have someone who's so brain scrambled, they just are constantly in need of new stimulus without being able to process anything that's right in front of them at all.
Right. And doesn't that sound exactly like a drug addiction?
It does.
It's the same thing, of course. Yeah. Because you look at somebody who's addicted to cocaine or heroin or meth, and they will tell you, I do this drug because it's awesome. And it's better than being bored and dealing with normal life. It's the exact same thing. You say, what if you
I
just sat?
didn't use that. But you've also given me an idea about the phone. We're talking smartphones here, not the telephone. I think there's a very, very major distinction
Huge difference, yeah,
between those two. And
huge.
I think it's actually hard to inventory how many points of difference there are. But He made me think that the real driving force behind the smartphone, the deep algorithm within society, is the cult of the individual. You know, that has been cultivated and nurtured into a real ubiquitous religion by corporate advertising. We've looked at the advertising messages that support that, and it turns people into indignant Karen-type consumers who think that they are the customer is always right because they know in their hearts that they're not really right. They're not really as important. They're never in that VIP line to go to the club. They really have major self-esteem issues. They feel lost in a society of machine learning and machine intelligence that's well beyond their grasp. They no longer trust the values of the past. They really have nothing to cling to other than this false idea that somehow, as consumers, they're significant. And anything that reinforces that and gives them more power rather than agency, because the power is in the device, they become dependent on that.
Ooh, you just made a very interesting distinction between power and agency. Oh, and I don't think very many people think of it in those terms. I certainly haven't. There is a fundamental difference between power and agency.
Yes, there is.
Going to bookmark that because I noticed exactly what you're talking about when I showed these kids Jurassic Park, which is a great book. It's a fun book. It's not up for debate, in my opinion. Is it the best written book ever? No, but it is entertaining. And a lot of them didn't like it and they wanted to get on their freaking TikToks and, you know, whatever. And I began to realize right then and there, oh, they don't hate Jurassic Park. They don't like the fact that Jurassic Park is not exactly what they want to be doing right now. Right. The customer is always right is a very interesting phrase to me because it's been truncated. That's not the original phrase. Do you know the original phrase?
I don't think I do. I was going to say that rang a bell, and then I thought I don't really have a something to draw into that. No.
So this is an old sales thing. The customer is always right in matters of taste. Meaning, if you want to go with the cornflower blue and the vermilion and the chartreuse wavy hippie pattern on your wall, you're right. You're right. Now, if you want us to do that in 15 minutes, 15 minutes from now, the customer's not always right. So that's an important distinction, too.
It's a huge distinction. It's a huge distinction. I think that's a very, very important contribution, David. I did not know that. I think that that has a wisdom and a common sense to it, and a depth of human knowledge that is in startling contrast to today. I mean, that adds levels of dimension and also narrows the perspective, narrows the frame of where the customer is right. To, I mean, I think that this is that the essential takeout is that that is now, although it's truncated, as you say, it's actually become 180 degrees difference in understanding because people assume that it means, well, they're just right. You know, I'm just right because I'm the customer, you know.
Nope, you're not right. And the thing is that you are right. If you're on your phone and you see something that you enjoy, you're always right. But are you always right to expect that that should be your life? That should be your truth 100% of the time? No. But we've worked to make that so. And I think that's really that's the major issue with all that is that it's just nonstop, it's constant. But I want to get back to the power and agency thing because this might be a big Lost Explorers idea. I would have put those together at first because to me, power equals agency because I think of power in terms of financial power. And financial power to me has always been about freedom, the ability to do what I want without somebody breathing down my neck. But really, in a lot of cases, that's not the case because there are different flavors of power. And I've been noticing the different flavors of power over the past 5 years, the power of the consumer to bring down artists, for example, by making specious claims about that artist that nobody ever attempts to validate or back up, whatever. It's just they did this, they should be gone. The artist or the consumer's ability to say that well, we want more Marvel and nothing else. Like that's a kind of power. But the problem is that now that power has made it so that there's no real agency in the art that's being made anymore. Like the difference between like the scimitar that cuts through the power and the agency is the algorithm. It's the blade has algorithm on it, right?
Oh, like that.
And so I think that's a really helpful way of thinking about like I'm not going to use those two words interchangeably anymore because they don't mean the same thing.
They really don't. And this is, an ongoing focus of mine in both the Big Memory and Alertness book, but also the extension of remediating 52 words over the course of a year, being able to look at those distinctions, because I think a lot of times we do two things as a habit in English speaking society. We use words interchangeably and sometimes whole phrases. Listeners may remember early on, Dave and I talked about the fact that statistically, the phrases mental health and mental illness are used interchangeably as if we can't decide which we're talking about. And I think that says a lot about the problems of treatment of mental issues, because we're really ambivalent about that. So sometimes we use synonyms interchangeably when there are really important connotative but nuanced differences that are more than just connotation usage differences. They really are conceptual. And then the other time, I think, is when we do just the opposite, and we don't see that words really have tremendous oppositional tension. And to be a little bit more alert to that really does open channels of thought, And this is what we have. For all people listening who are readers and have missed some of the mind scrambling that we're talking about with the smartphone generation, there really is a way to get more alert and more agency in our lives through attentiveness to language. And I'm not sure these younger people have that ability now. I don't know. I worry.
It's what worries me too. Yeah, absolutely. I've noticed a real problem with students being able to advocate for themselves and what they really need. I've seen a lot of frustration, a lot of on a younger child level. I took Gus to the park yesterday in Farmers Branch, Texas.
Wow.
It was a great park, though. It was a great park. But I noticed a lot of the kids there were older than Gus, sometimes by several years, and they were not vocal, like alarmingly subvocal,
Really?
grunting, motioning. Gus would go up to these kids, Gus, not even 3 years old, and start talking to them. Most of them didn't have anything to say back. Like sometimes there would be gangs of them, like three of them. Gus would talk to them, and the three would like look at each other And then they would go off like hooting like monkeys.
God, you have created such a vivid picture in my mind. And I'm really like, I'm all the way into Gus's perspective about this. He has a birthday coming up not too long from now, doesn't he? Couple of months.
About a month from yesterday.
Okay, so God, it's gone so fast. You must really think that. But I was trying to think what his perspective, with these older kids who are kind of, you've created this wonderful primal horde of almost bestial subhumans, something out of like the island of Dr. Moreau, H.G. Wells, are we not men? But not as noble, not anywhere near as noble, something really quite disturbing. And I think going sub-vocal, you're really then the obvious connection is subhuman. It really starts to feel very, very weird. And I think that is not far off the mark of where we are going, much quicker than we might even fear.
Well, because the kids who I was used to, my niece, for example, my niece has been talking since she was two as well. My sister would bring my niece over and just nonstop chatter, and she'd go out to the playground and talk to kids, but it's not my kid, so I'm not paying that much attention to it. But there were kids who did talk, for sure. They existed, but they were the minority of this kind of just, I don't even know, just silent, grunting. Hooting majority. But do you want to hear about my imaginative challenge?
Yes.
All right, cool. So this one's kind of interesting. So I'm going to give you my aborted idea first, where the woods are all petrified, the volcanic rock has a sheen of lacquer on it, the streams don't move anymore. It's not the Matrix per se, but a kind of inversion of it where we have taxidermied everything. So that was the idea that I had in the
Oh,
middle
okay.
of
I
what you were
like it.
talking about, before you got to your actual thrust of the imaginative challenge. So instead of a computer reconstructing real life, we have an inversion of the Matrix where now we have siliconized our real life environment. But here's more to your prompt. The taxidermy of the future would have to approximate the uncertainty that I experienced when I was a child. A lot of wires, kind of 90s cyberpunk aesthetic, compact computers and Palm Pilots, but wires are the taxidermy 25 years from now. Things having wires is important. Phones with wires, TVs with wires, computers with wires, everything gets bigger and boxier, walls lined with monitors, wall phones, and yes, even more wires. So the scenario for this sort of setting is that a person 25 years from now has invited his friends over for an old school LAN party. So LAN parties were something that we did when I was in high school, where you would bring your computer to a friend's house and you'd hook four computers up to a LAN and you would play shooters together. Still social, but kind of like, you could kill each other. And so this to somebody 25 years from now is completely foreign. This is a rediscovery of this kind of thing. And I would want to write this as a play in which four guys who are not used to face-to-face contact are faced with each other, both simultaneously experiencing a kind of uncanny nostalgia for an area, for a kind of time that they never lived in, but that they also have to find their language and learn to communicate with each other while killing each other in Quake. I think that could be a nice, it's a nice shift. It's a nice quiet three-act play where we have four characters who would each embody a different archetype of our time, who are then faced with not totally out in the woods, but in this kind of taxidermied, heavily wired set, right, with computers everywhere, a kind of fetishization of this past almost analog computer style that I think could be really cool.
Almost Analog could be a good working title. David, I think this, I mean, you always have something really, really intriguing as a response. I think this might be one of my personal favorites because I think you really bowled it over and really surprised me. I love the idea of a play. It kind of makes me think of a strange mashup of Sam Shepard and William Gibson. But yet,
That's good.
that's a wild combo, isn't it? But I think you've claimed ownership of that as your own idea. I felt a little tingle of electric excitement when you said wires. I think that was a real brilliant insight as to what the taxidermy of tomorrow would be. It's exactly because everything is going to be wireless, more and more Wi-Fi, Neuralinks, and ubiquitous computing in our clothes, on and on and on. And so, yes, the seizing on that nostalgia, that elegiac grasp for the past, wires, I think that's another nice, just simple title. Not wired, but wires. I
Wires,
really
yeah,
love
or
that.
a taxidermy of wires. That's kind of cool too. But yeah, no, I like wires. I like this idea. It could also be a really low budget, fun short film because you'd only need one set, you know. I might look into that because I want to direct something in the next 5 years.
Think you'd be really good at that. I think that you'd be really good at that. And I like the idea. The theater has tremendous appeal to me. I started off in that, and I think that we're never going to lose interest in it. Practically speaking, you could do that very simply, a one set sort of thing. And really the core of it is the interaction of the characters. So I think that would be a really beautiful black box play that you could then shoot as a film because it is a play. You don't have to, it's not a film of a play. It would work really well all around. I love that. I think that was really cool. And the set design, that would be really fun.
That'd be the whole budget would be the actors and the set design. And then just me and a camera and a sound guy kind of filming these scenes. I think that could really work.
A black magic could make that's cinema quality, I think that'd be real. I could really see you doing that. That would be really cool. I like that idea on every level.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. I'm happy about that. Do you have a tool and a tip for us today?
Yeah, I do. And I was thinking about, because the tool, we try to sort of keep it on a larger sort of level, and then the tip is more sort of practical. I'm not sure if that they might actually be reversed, but I'll go with what I had originally. It struck me in a sort of meditative moment that we like maps, that's a lost explorer's idea, and then the relationship of maps to language. I started thinking of a kind of timeline map of street names that houses, where I've lived. And it was interesting. I started sort of, assembling, and I got very quickly to, I think, what is a not surprising dynamic. But the first one I came up with was Windsor Avenue. The second one was Via Serena.
I like that.
Yeah. And pretty soon a pattern begins to form. Very English sounding names alternate with Spanish names. That's not surprising anywhere, but particularly where I was growing up. And I thought that's a really interesting way of showing how, in very personal terms, how history and language intertwine. Because the contrast is very stark. Extremely straightforward English names. You can't get any more English than Windsor and Via Serena or Dolores Street. You get these, it's a very, very, and then when later things emerge, they get to names of that are kind of gold rushy, like mineral, street names like or quartz, White Quartz Road. I lived on that in Australia. So I think it's interesting to think about that, and it's a way of going back over our lives. I mean, for one, the question is how many different streets do you remember growing up? I mean, maybe some people have a lot more than others. But I think it's an interesting perspective gathering technique about our life that I hadn't thought of. It just occurred to me kind of organically. And suddenly, this real opposition between the English and the Spanish names became very obvious, and it's inescapable for me.
I like that a lot because living in El Paso, Rockford Court, Elkhorn Street, Rojas, Cielo Vista, Pedro Figari, and then Whitechapel. You know what I mean? Like that, and that's the border. That's literally the border, like where all these different languages or these two different languages are colliding and the streets collide similarly. I think that's really cool.
It's interesting, we can't get away from these things. This is why, as language people, we maintain how important that is. And it, but it's structural. It really is all around us. It's not just on the conceptual level. It's streets, the streets we live on. So here's my tip. And I started off with a kind of a very simple idea that I think this actually applies to any form of writing that one does. It isn't just fiction or supposedly creative writing, but I think nonfiction benefits everything. My proposition is everything could possibly benefit from a storyboard. And I'm thinking of a kind of spiral maze storyboard, not something too linear. I'm hoping that that storyboard isn't just always a left to right reinforcement of linearity. I don't think that's what we mean by a storyboard. But then I thought about something that I'm recommending for the Memory and Alertness book. I have a lot of really beautiful architecture and design books, but occasionally when I'm at the university and in between classes, I go to the School of Architecture and look at the 300 and beautiful fine arts books, and I drool over them and just think, oh, there is something very powerful on meditating on architecture and design images.
Absolutely.
I think that
100%.
it is so deep and so powerful that thinking people striving for more clarity of mind, to destructure, to find new levels of structure and harmonics, it's a great technique. I did think a little bit about some of the mechanics of this, how it works. I sort of call them hidden bonuses. One is, I think that you can almost always guarantee, by definition, an extremely high level of quality in the photography. So while you're looking at apparently like a John Lautner design or you're also getting some tremendously crafted, skilled, aesthetically pleasing photography. And to the point where that's transparent, you almost don't even notice it. And yet it really is very, very enriching. And I think this going back to our last episode of representation versus reality, this is one of those really precious moments where the representation becomes an extension of the subject. They merge rather than in opposition. There's an osmosis of subject and object. And I have found when the moment I really thought clearly about that, I started looking at a whole range of my architecture books. There's a earlier, I think I showed you up. There's a sort of a really beautiful but circular, strange house in Japan that you like. The depths of satisfaction in looking at that. And I think we're free in a Jalan-Jalan sense to not go, well, we have to live there, because we don't. We get to just enjoy it at a distance and yet very connected to it. And then to get that sense of deep structure coming out of it. I really, really think for people who are feeling fragmented today and who's not, that meditating on beautiful architecture and design images, even just for short bursts, is just tremendous. You, our projective target acquisition part of our imagination is activated, and we get to confront a literal nexus of physical and conceptual structure. I mean,
Absolutely.
you can't think of a more demonstrative example of where concept and structure joint than architecture.
Oh, totally. I mean, longtime listeners of this show will know that, for my birthday 2 years ago, Rios bought me an encyclopedia of Japanese architecture. And I think a lot of my best story ideas come from looking at architecture. And I think that if this is one of your first listens to Lost Explorers, I would recommend, start with the basics. Go look up some Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. I mean, you'll fall down an actual good rabbit hole
Yeah.
for hours, because they are amazing and you can just stare at them from different angles too. Because in Frank Lloyd Wright's case, so many people have taken so many photos. I mean, you can look at hundreds of them and it's actually enriching to the soul, especially if there's no people in them.
Yes, absolutely. I certainly agree with that latter point. I think it really is an object of deep meditative power. And it's an interesting kind of mandala. The technique works across a range of different things. But what Dave and I are talking about right now is a sense of an engagement with structure that is happening on a soulful level. Which that I mean that's sort of bringing logos, mind, and pathos, the reason and intellect with the heart, the psychology, and I think soulful is exactly the takeout I get from that. And there's so many wonderful examples. And again, to go back to one of our favorite publishing companies, Taschen does a beautiful series
Oh,
of
they do. Oh, they
extremely
do.
affordable books.
No, Taschen is great. I would recommend on a similar tip to architecture, cars.
Yes.
Looking at some really nice Japanese imports, some Italian cars. I mean, and actually, if you get into the weeds with this, you can look at their manufacture process. You can get under the hood. I think those two are, if you want the internet to not suck, just start Googling on JDMs and Frank Lloyd Wright and just go and let the internet take, like, because that is one area, probably due to the fact that it's really hard to monetize architecture for obvious reasons. That is one area of the internet, two areas, I should say, that have yet to really be co-opted by the algorithm to try to directly sell you something. Now, they might try to sell you like an architecture course or some bullshit, whatever, but just ignore that and just keep going. because there's nothing they can do. You can't do anything with a high-rise building because none of your customers are scrolling Instagram at that moment and thinking, I'd like to buy a high-rise building right now, you know?
That's well said. That's well said. You can really browse and go Jalan Jalan to your heart's content with a minimum of, intrusive secondary levels of information, which is hard to do on today's internet, as we all know. And we can get hounded by sometimes information that we really do want. We just don't want so much of it right then. And that, of course, the purpose of the meditative practice is to really just free the mind and to find in profound structuring a freedom from structure, a moment of freedom from one's own structures to rethink the idea of structure. And it makes me think of, Wright was in a kind of category all his own. I mean, we really,
Totally.
Frank
One of
Gehry,
my heroes for sure.
just and to read some of his, his objectives, a small house with plenty of room, I just what I savor from that is just makes me more sensitive of the orientation of space, how that works.
Oh yeah, totally. And people, by the way, go buy right now In Praise of Shadows. In Praise of Shadows. I wish every book read like In Praise of Shadows.
I love that book. You turned me on to that. I went out, I got that. That's on my Kindle.
I mean, 10 pages on toilets, Japanese toilets in the 1930s, but it's fascinating. You don't want to read anything else when you're reading that. Tell me more about why you think this poor guy, his the mental gymnastics he had to do to try to fit a cook stove in his house because of how ugly they were, is worth the price of admission alone. But no, I you know what? I never pursued it, and at this point I probably won't, but I really like being a diehard fan of architecture and spaces, of just understanding that that's not going to be my mysticism. I'm not going to ever. It's kind of like watching an NBA game or something. I'm on a different path. I'm more on the writer, well, I guess just the writer, teacher, thinker tip of things. But I really like that there are people out there who are really freaking good at architecture, and I can just appreciate it.
I think that's a great way to put it. And I think you've helped me articulate what my deep fascination, just a magnetic attraction to the field is. Because I don't think I have any aptitude for this at all. I tried when I was a kid. I was always, doing blueprints and stuff. And I would have, like more secret staircases and hidden panels than bathroom. I had no sense of practicality, no sense of real dimension and proportion. But it's an art form that we can deeply enjoy without having any sort of competitive desire to be within that frame. We can just simply appreciate it. And I really dig that. I think you've said that well. Every creative person needs some field like that resonates with them, but they don't have high stakes in it personally. Simply savor it, I think that's really, really, really important. That
Absolutely. I agree. My dream life has been re relatively quiet this week. How about yours?
It was quiet and then it really cranked up. And I've got two different streams here, and I'd kind of like to share both because they're so different. The first one, and it goes, I think, interesting to your connection of tourism actually having a kind of erotic appeal, because I think that picks up on this of there were girls in bikinis. And what was, I think I was picking up on maybe some of the spring break Florida sort of news, but this was extremely physical and tangible. And their bodies were really taut and firm, and yet not overly athletic. And I thought to myself, you know, it's unusual to find it ha those have to be young bodies, strangely fit, not puffy or frail. And I think I'm around a lot of young people with my students, and not many of the young women have bodies. I was trying to think where did, and I remembered this wet New Zealand gal that I met in Fiji, and she had that kind of a sort of an electric sort of appeal, just the right sort of flesh, but toned, you know? And then I thought, and it really just freight trained me, a chick from Missouri that I ended up slow kissing in this rain gutter one night in Annemasse, France, which is near the border, near the Swiss border, so not too far from Geneva, but it's a really dubious, unpicturesque French town. Lots of high rises, and yeah, there are cobblestones, and they were glistening in the rain that night with this chick who just, God, she was just a kiss I remember, you know, down the years. There were these Algerian thugs on mobilettes skidding past us, cursing and throwing bottles. So this real contrast. And I woke up from this dream and wrote, an edge of menace held to the soft throat of the wet evening, clutching a passionate girl with a voice like a liqueur. So that was wondering. Then I think because of the vividness of that, I was rewarded with the first major image-focused dream rather than narrative-focused in a while. And I came upon this relief map, very large, about 15 feet by 15 feet, maybe more. But it was really a haptic musical synthesizer. No glass case around it. Hanging overhead were these rows of various extension devices to reach out across the map and stimulate different portions that otherwise would be out of reach. There were sticks of different kinds, expandable pointers, rods with feather tips, and then there were things that looked like eels or large worms that operated by remote control that I could send across the map, crawling across the map and get them to stop at different points. So between the two, the pointer things, stimulating things, and these worm-like things, there were also little totems like miniature dice or coins that could be tossed onto the map at strategic musical moments. And I woke up thinking, I've heard sounds I've never heard before. And my first thought was, I should get my blowgun and see what that does to, you know, with darts hitting the map. So I woke up with this sense of this really rich visual imagery, but music coming out of the terrain.
Also, not every sex dream has sex in it,
That's
right?
right.
So that
Right.
also feels very much like a sex dream to me.
Yeah.
I really like this kind of tactile relief map where your hands are forced to use instruments and kind of
Yes.
reach across, but you can send the worm out, and the worm does its own thing. You feel what I'm saying? You feel me? I really dig that, and I think that I like its simplicity, and also its beauty, because the idea of sounds that you haven't heard before, you might not ever be able to recreate them, but you heard them.
Yeah. And I think that gets back to, what you were saying about that sort of that notion of eroticism that's fundamentally unfulfilled, that then somehow it can be enjoyed and savored as something that's not quite within reach. Maybe we don't need everything within reach. Maybe we need that sense of not being teased, but titillated.
Titillated is a good word. And I think that if you go back to when I was a kid, titillation was everything. That's what TV was. And there wasn't real sex on TV. There certainly wasn't Pornhub. There was at best a scrambled Cinemax channel that I would watch, like the Zapruder film, waiting for the exact moment when the two channels crossed over and you saw a boob or some woman riding a guy or whatever. And the more I think about it, the more that I think eroticism, masturbation, titillation, I think that's actually the ideal way to go about it. You gotta kind of earn it, right? You have to exist in this like 13-year-old sweat of just, oh my God, I gotta see something or I'm gonna go nuts. And you sit there and you spend 3 hours of your God-given life waiting to see a boob. And by the time you do, you're ready to bust. Like you're done. Like you don't need to see penetration, nothing. You're good. You're ready to go. That is the difference between this kind of eroticism and this erotic way. I like this idea of like kind of an erotic way of living where you're not fucking all the time. You know what I mean? It's not, you're not constantly having sex, but you're always being titillated, which I like your distinction. Again, we have two very important distinctions in this episode: power and agency, and teasing and titillation. Not the same thing. Teasing and a lot of guys, unfortunately, who get in a lot of trouble mistake titillation for teasing. And then they take it forward. Titillation is just emblematic. It just is what it is. It's not symbolizing anything. It just is. And I want more of that back. I mean, right now, I'm a little busy. I can't be titillated by very much. I went to the zoo on Wednesday, and of course, there's, but you don't even see women that way at this point in my life. You're just kind of like, meh. It's another person who's in the way of this hippopotamus that my kid's trying to see. But one day it would be fun. It would be fun to get back to that kind of, that stage where you're not trying to have sex with people so much as just erotically engaged in the same kind of noospheric field as they are, perhaps. It's fun. It's a cool way to live.
Beautifully said. I really think that, and I think that it's kind of in looking for eroticism in different ways, and often so literally and concretely, we end up being dissatisfied or constantly needing ever more stimulus that way. I think that ties back to the formula of drug addiction and the phone.
Totally. Yeah,
And
totally.
it becomes, and I think it is something that is that's really quite annoying. I'm really glad you mentioned it because it is something I do bring up in the memory and alertness book of you've helped me try because I was trying to think about, I mean, we don't want to put all thoughts of sex or eroticism aside. Do want to have more agency, I think, with those thoughts. And I think that what we seek, what thinking curious people are really seeking, is an erotic mindset.
Yeah, no,
Everything
100%.
fits into that. That's really what you're saying.
Yeah.
It far transcends sex. It embraces it, but it's much more along the lines of a total sensuality of psychological experience.
That's it. That's it. I think that you can look at right-wing influencers who have you heard of NoFap?
No.
No, well, fapping is masturbating.
Right.
And so NoFap is this idea that you can't masturbate. You have to preserve your semen for masculinity purposes. The whole thing's a little gay, to be honest with you.
What
But
age group is it aimed at? I mean,
18 to 35, buddy. I mean, the same one. I mean, young men. I just said that 35
they'd
was young.
explode. I mean, you're just gonna have like
You
a
got a lot of dudes walking around,
event.
especially like bodybuilder dudes, because they may, and this is, a science that it doesn't matter how many times you come. That doesn't affect your testosterone. That's silly. That's goofy. But that's the way that they've logicked this kind of thing
Right,
out.
right, right. Okay, no, I haven't heard of this.
But the problem with NoFap is that it is a you're kind of you're it's almost like they're kind of getting to it, where by going back to a sort of Puritanism, you're burying eroticism under never masturbating and layers of clothing, and you just don't look at that girl, or you might, that's all very sexy in and of its own kind of thing. That's not what we're saying at all, right? It's just a more engaged way of using your agency to approach that kind of thing, right? So you're not that guy, but you're also not what the kids are calling the coomer. And the coomer is the bleary-eyed, disheveled-haired masturbator who's just jerking off 24/7. It's
Wow.
basically just being a normal person, but
Well, you've really just sketched out the crucial difference, between Jung and Freud.
yeah.
I mean, Freud was really got stopped on the level of repression and the dangers of that. And I don't think he went to the point of somehow a tantric level of repression that would somehow be really, strangely fulfilling, kind of like fasting,
Right.
Jung is really about integration and balance and how to kind
Integration, integrating the shadow. Yeah, it's integrating the shadow of the masturbator.
of. Dear.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. But seriously though, I mean, that literally is it. It's integrating that shadow, because you're neither afraid of it nor consumed by it and obsessed with it. You just live it in a really healthy way. But it's getting late over here, so we're going to wrap this one up.
Yes, okay, well, really well done. And you just on every level, I will say, David did absolutely expertly manage to integrate his two chosen words into tonight's discussion. So if you were attentive, you might have heard, but I don't know. He's awfully good at it. It was very
Slipped them in.
and you could tell. I mean, we do Zoom, so we can see each other while we're talking. And I know when David is just really just has this totally under control, because there's a kind of a very subtle slam dunk. And I love when that comes through. I thought that the taxidermy of tomorrow's prompt response was sensational. I think people should go back and listen to that. And I, David, if you want to write a play on that, I think that you'd get a lot of interesting collaborative help. Anybody in set design would want to be part of that.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think I'm really hot on that idea right now. So before I go to bed, I might actually start tapping some things away. But I mean, as always, the idea of the difference between power and agency, that's a life and thought changing idea. I really don't think that view listeners rather might have heard that. So again, go back and listen to what Chris said, because the separation of power and agency is so major that you could probably write a book about that.
Thank you, Dave, for you always help really bring things to the fore. And I, one of our key points is that certain thoughts appear because of certain conversations. And we owe it to ourselves and to our fellow travelers and lost explorers, have those conversations and discover things together. And we certainly appreciate people listening. We're heading towards our 200th episode.
Getting close. We're getting close. We're edging. We're not
Edge.
teasing. We're not teasing. Not teasing. We're getting titillated by 200.
Yes, there you go. There you go.
All right, sir.
All right. Thanks, everyone.